The clerk will call the docket.
Marcellus McQuinn against the Commonwealth of Virginia, Daniel Wayne Hall, Appellant Counsel. Fred Vincent Scholar, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Daniel Hall, and I am on brief for Mr. McQuinn in this matter. And Justice Lemons, if I may reserve 5 minutes of rebuttal.
All right.
I was asked by a lay person to explain to them in one sentence why Mr. McQuinn should win, and I couldn't do it. But I think to this learned court, I can say it in one sentence, and that sentence is that Mr. McQuinn, at trial by counsel, asked for the right remedy and not the wrong remedy. And in the law, the same result can turn on whether or not you ask for the right remedy. And for that reason, McQuinn says that the argument about inconsistent verdicts and whether or not they're permissible or whether or not you can challenge them is a non sequitur here, because Mr. McQuinn, through counsel, moved to set aside the verdict in a timely manner under 3A15 and cited statutory authority. Trial counsel mentioned the words inconsistent verdicts, but his argument was that this honorable court's decision in Jay versus Commonwealth affirmed that 18253.1 requires the Commonwealth to prove that the defendant had committed one of the enumerated offenses.
Counsel, you mentioned you intended that you tried to explain it to a layperson and you couldn't.
Right.
Well, a jury is composed of lay people.
Correct.
And sometimes they pay perfect attention to the instructions and sometimes they don't.
That's correct.
As the U.S. Supreme Court has noted, and let me quote from their Dunn case, jurors sometimes assume a power which they had no right to exercise but to which they were disposed through lenity. What are your thoughts about that?
My thoughts about that are that there is no remedy in Virginia to ask for us to analyze why a jury made the decisions it made. And that doesn't matter here because the General Assembly already made that decision. Because Jay says that you cannot be guilty of that offense, use of a firearm, if you have not committed one of the enumerated offenses. Juries don't know much about a lot of things. We tell juries that they are supposed to use all of the relevant evidence, and yet collateral motions are filed, and rulings are made under the exclusionary rule or evidentiary rules, and the jury never hears that information.
But as Justice Minch just pointed out, there's a difference between a jury trial and a bench trial. And the court may very well have the problem of trying to figure out where the error was when a juror asks.
That's true.
But we don't have any problem figuring out who made the error when it's a bench trial.
If I can answer that with a hypothetical, what if a trial judge says, I think this was some kind of an argument over drugs. I'm finding your client not guilty of robbery, but he had a gun. I'm finding him guilty of use of a firearm. Well, Your Honor, I don't think you can do that. Counsel, be quiet. I just saved your client from 5 to life. Have a nice day. So then the lawyer appeals that. Is this court saying that when a trial judge doesn't announce why they made a decision, that we would say that the firearm conviction can stand? And then the answer, I don't think.
I'm saying just the opposite. When a judge makes the error, we can identify it pretty clearly. When a jury makes the error, we're not really quite sure what they're doing. Where is the error that occurred? And we let juries, frankly, they listen to instructions. They listen particularly to the instructions on sentencing. And sometimes juries are involved in a little bit of nullification here and nullification there. And we understand that. And it's a part of the jurisprudence of Western society for hundreds of years now. But we don't let judges do that.
In this case, of course, though, Mr. McQuinn asked the judge to rule on the entry of these final orders. And I think that's part of the difference. Part of the difference, I think, is that the General Assembly has decided what the law is in this area. And so the ordinary common law jurisprudence of not invading the jury's decision-making does not apply where the General Assembly has spoken. And this court, frankly, cannot overrule that. And so the General Assembly has made the statement, unless Jay was decided wrongly. It's notable that the Attorney General's office didn't cite Jay in their brief. And that's because Jay is out there, and it says, if you have not committed this offense, you cannot be found guilty of this.
But that's sort of obvious, isn't it? If you don't commit the predicate offense, you can't be, under a sufficiency analysis, you can't be held liable for the compound offense. I don't know why that strikes you as a killer argument. That's a truism, right? But here, a jury has made what appears to be an inconsistent verdict. We don't know if you got hosed on one or you got lucky on the other. So we presume the best, unless you can show us, as you can with a bench trial, that a judge makes an obviously wrong acquittal and compound conviction. We presume the best with juries because, as the Chief was alluding, sometimes juries do cut defendants' breaks, particularly in multiple count indictments. And that's why the court has always been, and the law has always been, historically deferential to the jury's ability to do that. We can never say a juror, you can never tell a jury, you can nullify if you think that the prosecutor is overcharged. But we know they do that. So why is this a difficult case?
Well, it's not a difficult case, Justice Kelsey. I think that's what Mr. McQuinn is saying. He's saying that this is a straightforward case of statutory interpretation, that this is different. And the Reed case was not decided wrongly, I don't think. And I don't think you don't really have to argue over Reed as trial counsel did. I raised it, and I'm not abandoning that argument, but I think that really, when you ask for the wrong remedy, you lose. And in Reed, they tried to analyze issue preclusion within the jury. Could the jury have found these elements? That's exactly what Your Honor is saying that we do not do. But when the General Assembly has created a predicate offense, and I think it is noteworthy that the cases cited by Sullivan, Dunn, and Powell, it's not really clear that there's a statutory framework that required a finding in one direction or another. In all of these cases about jury inconsistency, it's an attempt to argue estoppel or issue preclusion within a verdict on multiple counts.
Yeah, I get that, but why isn't that really what you're doing without using the same rhetoric?
It is, but it's a different remedy. I'll give you an example. If someone submits a test to a state lab for sexually transmitted disease from out of state and the defendant objects and says, objection, that's the confrontation clause, they lose. If the defendant had said, objection, that's hearsay, and the doctor who's reading it in open court did not diagnose this, that's an inadmissible expert opinion in a criminal case, this court says they win. Same evidence, one remedy, you lose. Ask for the right remedy, you win. Justice Kelsey, that's how the law works. The statute says what it says. This honorable court has said what that statute said. The defendant asked the judge not to decide anything about the jury, but to simply state, okay, we've tried it to a jury. They heard McQuinn testify. They heard all the evidence. They acquitted him. So that statement that is often used in these cases, we do not know whose ox was gored. Respectfully, sir, we do.
But they acquitted him. They acquitted him, meaning, on your best scenario, they didn't believe unanimously that beyond a reasonable doubt had been met.
Correct.
But all it takes to be sufficient under a Reed analysis is a rational jury could find beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. And we know from the bell-shaped curve of litigating cases that there's a lot in between those two poles.
I agree. And I think it's noteworthy that trial counsel didn't argue about sufficiency. But then again, why would you be arguing about sufficiency of the evidence when you won and when the jury has acquitted your client of the predicate offenses? That sort of doesn't make any sense.
Why isn't Jay a sufficiency case? Why isn't Jay a sufficiency case in your case or Reed case?
Jay is definitely a sufficiency case.
Okay.
Have to acknowledge that without any doubt. That's a very good point, Justice Kelsey. But I guess from the point of view of the analysis of the law, when someone is acquitted, you cannot say that they have committed that offense.
No, but we also can't say as a matter of law that the evidence was insufficient, which is the whole point distinguishing Jay from Reed. For all we know, they went back there and said he's guilty of both of these. He's guilty of all of these, but the prosecution is overcharged. We want to find some rough justice. And that's their prerogative. They have that.
And that certainly is the opposing argument, Justice Kelsey. I have to acknowledge that clearly. That's exactly what's called for by the briefs from both sides here. But let me give you a scenario and test that. What if a jury finds me not guilty of robbery on January 1st, and then the Commonwealth goes to the next grand jury and indicts me for use of a firearm in the commission of that robbery.
The problem there is you have a Virginia statute that precludes that.
Okay.
So it's not going to ever happen.
Right. Okay.
So, counsel, I think the challenge here is that you are arguing this as if it's binary, as if there are two counts and one of them was an acquittal and one of them was a conviction. And as Justice Kelsey mentioned, we've actually, if I count correctly, we have 11 counts here. Three convictions, seven acquittals, and one where there was no verdict.
That's correct.
And that makes your argument a whole lot more difficult to analyze in terms of the what you're trying to convince us of. It really does appear to be a jury that reached a compromise. But we can't know that, and we can't go into the jury room and say, oh, no, sorry about that, you can't do that. We're just not permitted to. But let me ask you this. Did you poll the jury?
I didn't try the case.
Okay.
I apologize, Justice Smith, I don't remember if it was polled. Mr. McCall often polls his jury, but I can't remember
okay.
this case. I'm sorry.
The transcript, at least at one point, they were both asked and if they wanted to poll the jury, and the answer was no. You're getting down 4 minutes. However, you haven't addressed the final assignment of error having to do with the Court of Appeals not reaching what is the third assignment of error in this case before us. What do you say about that?
What I say about that is that's an embarrassing typographical error in the argument section, and it's very embarrassing to have to argue that before this honorable court. But I don't think it had any of it was any consequence.
Well, what is the type of what is the error?
The error was that it stated wrongly in the argument section that he was complaining of a use of a firearm in a robbery when it should have been a use of a firearm in the malicious wounding of Javon Humphreys, and yet the assignments of error correctly stated what error was assigned, and the notice of appeal had the correct case numbers for what was appealed. The Court of Appeals' conclusion was that I'd argued a case that he had been acquitted on, but that's a typographical error when it's clear from the whole record, the assignment of error and the notice of appeal. I could not have argued a case that he was acquitted on because I did not appeal such a case. So it was an insubstantial error under the standards announced in Jay versus Commonwealth.
Well, I guess if the objective here is to give the Commonwealth notice of what your assignment of error is and the court notice, I don't know that it's insubstantial. But you have 2 minutes, 30 seconds left. You may keep it or you may keep arguing.
I'm done. I'd submit the case to the court, Justice Lemons.
All right. You're waiving your oral argument before you hear from the Commonwealth?
Well, the last few minutes, I'll say.
All right, you have 2 minutes, 31 seconds left.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Craig Stallard on behalf of the Commonwealth. First, let me address the opponent's argument regarding the different remedies. It's, while a different semantics to say I'm challenging it because it's inconsistent verdicts versus challenging it because the evidence is insufficient, those are basically two ways of saying the same thing. And the United States Supreme Court in Powell addressed the sufficiency of the evidence part of the component, which I have quoted on page 14 of my brief, which basically states that respondent's argument that an acquittal on a predicate offense necessitates a finding of insufficient evidence on a compound felony count simply misunderstands the nature of the inconsistent verdict problem. Whether presented as an insufficient evidence argument or an argument that the acquittal on the predicate offense should collaterally stop the government on the compound offense, the argument necessarily assumes that the acquittal on the predicate offense was proper, the one the jury really meant. And that's the problem. We don't know what the jury did or why the jury did it. So to suppose that the acquittal was the one that they actually meant and the other one is incorrect is not supported by the record and is the basis for why the
But his argument, in part, is that we've sort of boxed ourselves in with Jay. But he's quite right. I didn't see you analyze that question in your brief.
Well, in Jay, the court itself cited Reed as an exception to Jay, saying Reed, we affirmed it because it was a jury verdict. And Jay, of course, was a bench trial. So the cases are different. And as the court mentioned earlier, clearly, if a bench or a judge was to make this type of finding, it would be reversed on appeal. and the Commonwealth would have no arguments to make to the contrary. Here, because it's a jury trial that's done this, and we don't know what happened in the room, and we'll likely never know how the jury came to these verdicts, the case law seems clear that, based on that alone, it's insufficient to challenge the convictions now. And that's not to say there's never a possibility of challenging the sufficiency. If there had been some argument that there's no evidence a gun was used or something outside of the fact regarding the predicate offense, then that would obviously be a different issue that could be raised. But merely asserting because the jury acquitted of Part A, you must now reverse Part B on appeal, fails just as a matter of law under both this Court's decision in Reed and under Dunn and Powell from the United States Supreme Court.
So tell me if I understand your argument succinctly in a single sentence to a layperson. He's arguing that he wins on the underlying offense and the compound offense has to go by the boards as well. Doesn't that presuppose that the underlying offense was an acquittal because it was insufficient evidence, as opposed to merely this jury decided reasonable doubt had not been met?
Yeah, that's quite possible, yes, Your Honor. I think what it is we can't know for certain that the jury acquitted because the evidence was insufficient, as opposed to...
Well, in theory, it would have never gotten to the jury if the evidence were insufficient.
Sure, the motion to strike, the judge would have struck it if it didn't amount to at least probable cause, some higher standard.
So the conceptual difference is between evidence which is insufficient as a matter of law, in which there would have to necessarily be an acquittal either by jury or by JNOV or by an appellate court reversal insufficiency, and a situation where the predicate and the compound offense are both within the bell-shaped curve of reasonable jurors, and they just either cut them a break on one or not on the other.
That's correct. And that's why jury verdicts are different from verdicts resulting from a bench trial, because we can't point to anything specific to explain why the verdicts are inconsistent. We don't know what happened in the jury room. And we leave that to the prerogative of the jury. And with respect to the second assignment of error, Your Honor, the error occurred in the argument section as opposed to the actual assignment of error in the Court of Appeals. So even assuming the court erred in dismissing it based on that typographical error, as the appellant has stated it, any error would be harmless. The two firearm offenses he's challenging were in the exact same legal posture. The analysis of the Court of Appeals would have been identical to both of them. So if they had addressed the merits, there's no reason to think it wouldn't have been the exact same analysis that was undertaken with the one that was addressed on the merits. And in any event, this court has granted the issue as to that claim as well. So if there was error, this court obviously has the ability to correct it and do what it feels is appropriate with the merits of the case as well. I'll be happy to answer any other questions this court may have. If you have no questions, I'd ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals and the trial court.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Would you like to use your rebuttal?
Thank you. Just briefly, I think it really comes down to the fact that I think we find ourselves now looking back at what the jury did to try to decide this case, and I don't think we can. The jury acquitted. And I think that's McQuinn's strongest point here.
But it doesn't mean the evidence was insufficient, and therefore they could have found him guilty, and therefore we don't know if they found him guilty or didn't find him guilty based upon their nullification sentiment or based upon their actual genuine belief that a reasonable doubt had not been met.
I understand what you're saying, Justice Kelsey, certainly very clearly. On the other hand, a motion to strike was made and the trial judge did what trial judges often do, which is say, this is a question for the jury to decide.
Well, you're not saying the evidence is insufficient on appeal, because obviously the evidence was sufficient. A reasonable jury could have found him and we would not vacate the verdict because of insufficient evidence.
And yet this reasonable jury acquitted of both.
Right, but in the context of an inconsistent verdict, that's the whole difficulty, is trying to figure out.
And
we're going round and round.
And this is, and there is, and Justice McCullough, there is a circular nature to this, but that's why I'm suggesting that the General Assembly has taken it out of that circular nature.
Right, is this a circuit breaker, if you will, statutorily?
Yes, sir, a circuit breaker that we can't find in the authority in Dunn and Powell and cases that have been relied on. And we concede that in that type of case, we are out of luck. But with this code section, we have a different story. And I thank the court and ask the court to rule in Mr. McQuinn's favor.
All right. Call the next game.